SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back on this Thursday. Feels like we literally just got off the air. Did nothing but watch racing and follow racing. And so it feels like we literally just coming back from the noon sign-off yesterday and listening to the end of the show from yesterday as well with the visit from Bob Baffert. Looking ahead as well to opening day tomorrow at Del Mar. And more, actually, got to do a little bit more work on the Stronach Pick 5, the 50,000-plus carryover into tomorrow. And that sequence will start at Laurel with the 8th, then go to Gulfstream Park West with the 8th, Laurel 9th, and Gulfstream West 9th, and Golden Gate 4th. So, this should be good. It's actually, I think, like this sequence more than the ones in recent weeks. We'll make for a fun Friday with Del Mar kicking off as well. They've got the Catherine Crosby as the opening day stake feature. And I printed it out. And between the sales figures and and the rest of the weekend stuff, it's piled in here somewhere. There we go. The opening feature, Del Mar, the Catherine Crosby. It's a restricted group. Non-winners of a sweepstake. Always love these. Usually brings together a fun group of horses. They're going to go a mile on the grass. And you got a full field lining up in here. And then into the weekend. It's actually not a huge kickoff to Del Mar for the weekend. They'll come back with the Let It Ride on Saturday and the Betty Grable on Sunday, and the Desi Arnaz on Veterans Day Monday. It's actually surprisingly quiet. Somewhat. It's the only Portland Meadows and Del Mar with stakes on Monday. Interesting. And then, of course, it's amazing to look at these schedules and realize that Fairgrounds is opening next week. Yeah. And if Fairgrounds is opening, that means it's almost Thanksgiving. And you know, it feels like Thanksgiving's being paved over by the retail community. You go into a store, and we've gone from Halloween to Christmas in 60 seconds. It's like Christmas stuff everywhere, and even here on the network, we've already started. When Tina and I were driving back from Louisville, SiriusXM's got the Christmas music going already. We'll wait. We'll wait for our Christmas music. People love our Christmas music. We have the best Christmas music. In fact, I have to start looking for some new additions. We're always digging deep when it comes to the holiday. Speaking of digging deep, you want to do some deep dives? The conversation with Pete Fornatel yesterday, and knowing that the BCBC team was going to release the specific wager-by-wager records, the complete day one, day two annals of the way people bet. And so you can peruse that now. I put out the link this morning on Twitter. And tomorrow with Nick Tamara, we'll go through Nick's plays. And I think this is a really important exercise. And we'll talk to Paul Matisse after the first break. Got a bunch of things to talk in the wake of Breeders' Cup with Paul. Of course, we met with him the Friday before. And we'll get some response to the changes that went on for BCBC rule-wise. But more importantly, too, the obviously the contest community is a certain segment. And they had almost 400 players. But the head-to-head wagers, and Paul explained this, and I see people criticizing the head-to-head. You have to start somewhere. As Paul explained, they've got a bigger idea and long-term concepts they're going to try to execute, and that includes whittling down the takeout number on the head-to-heads from 10 to 7 to 5. So we're scoffing at what value, quote unquote, these head to heads offered, but it was a starting point. It's unbelievable. You got to start somewhere. So Paul will talk about how he heard what the responses were, what he thought of the values quotient as they played out. Going to talk about how he did. We always have a fun postmortem when it comes to the bankroll. Paul, and Paul's always so self-deprecating. He'll say how many mistakes he made and but as you heard from Chuck Rubbs, and when you see it in print, and even I printed out Nick's sequence of wagers. Most of the players, when you look at how they did through Breeders' Cup through the 2 days, they had to make three bets on day one, a minimum of three. They could have made more, but a minimum of three. And on all the cup races, and then day two, I think they had to make six or seven. So going through the majority of the players who scored, you can see that they really, for the most part, are just like every other player. They had their hits in two or three races. And you also get why one of the reasons this is valuable, and we'll do it with Nick, you also see structurally how they wagered. What kind of horses did they bet to win? What price range? What where did they weigh their exactas? Keying a horse, $60 exacta box, $100 exactas, $200 exactas. The way in which they structured the bets. I think this is a terrific opportunity for players of all shapes and sizes. I mean, bankroll-wise, not waistline. So we'll talk to Paul. Always great. Brad Cox will join us, too, this hour. We'll catch up with Tony. We haven't had a chance. We missed Tony the last 2 weeks. I feel terrible, and we have yet to – we got to congratulate him still on his win from a week ago Sunday. I'm going to ask him his experience with Willard Thompson over the years. And everything else that you can do with Tony. Steve Askin, of course, later as well. Second half. And more. We've got to catch up with Rich Eng. I don't know if we'll maybe do Quigley. Might do Quigley today or maybe Quigley tomorrow. Not sure. We also got more trainer conversations. Before we head to the break and before Paul joins us, quick glance at yesterday. Keeneland, second of the 2 days of book two, third day overall, and a Judmont broodmare, a young one, Miss Exclusive. This is a big boost to the second half of book two. $750,000 from this exclusive, and this an important family, obviously, when it comes to the Judmont broodmare community. And very rarely do these come out. They become, you know, very much collector's items. Greg Goodman from Mount Brilliant, and Goodman said that he tried at Tattersall's to buy into the family. This is the family of Hasili, Intercontinental, and that's where Miss Exclusive comes from. And you know, this is the kind of broodmare that a band like Mount Brilliant Farm, they treasure these types. And, you know, ideally they'll get themselves a couple of daughters and, you know, go from there. But another very good session, and 3 days into the Keeneland November, the numbers pretty much match up very nicely. And if you just look at this book, too, interestingly, the average was identical. That's pretty funny. 218,166 versus 218,329. But the median up 15%, and the buybacks were about the same, 27% versus 26. Some interesting distribution here of bloodstock, and when it came to the babies, what happened to my? Here we go, weanlings, top weanling. A Tappet colt out of Sweet Dreams, 380,000. Busker Stables, bought by Alex Solis and Jason Litt. It was also an Into Mischief filly, Spendthrift. 360, another Quality Road. Making a nice splash, as always, and that included another colt. Al Freed, well-known here in New York, bred the $310,000 colt that went to Chestnut Valley. Who was the top filly? Where's the top filly? Don't see the filly. All colts yesterday. Oh, no, the filly, the top filly was the Spendthrift, Into Mischief, that they bought. Bred by Hunter Valley and Pat Barrett. Well, good day. Another good day, and things continue till what, next Friday, I think. Right? Next Friday. And we'll thank Nicole Russo for her visit yesterday. What else do we have here news-wise? I'll save some of that. No rush. A little bit more of the Election Day fallout. T.D. Thornton wrote a good piece. I guess in Idaho, they were trying to open the door for historic racing, and there's a group that was hoping to reopen Le Bois, and that ballot measure failed. So it doesn't not a good prospect in Idaho. Arkansas, too, a wider licensing parameter that'll allow Oaklawn to put in authentic gaming equipment. When I say authentic, not that historical racing is not authentic. I don't want to get the family values people upset. Take a break. Thursday at the races. Paul Matisse joins us next.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
DRF Sportsform Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sportsform delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsform. Enter code DRF Sports.
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and Kent the Summer on Afternoon Delights, absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
Down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's dancing behind movie scenes, behind the movie scenes. Sadi Rani, she's the one that keeps the dream alive. From the morning past the evening to the end of the life. Brian Proof, Asher on the 45. Well, it's
we're back at the races. Coming up on 20 into hour one, and back with Paul Matisse. Of course, we checked in with Paul ahead of the Breeders' Cup, part of a number of changes and innovations to the betting menu and the contest. And we do a postscript as well. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. You know, I teased you so much about you and Sheikh Mohammed being buddies, and then you were on the TV all the whole weekend in the Winner's Circle and stuff. So I'm watching the Melbourne Cup, and I'm waiting to see you and Sheikh Mohammed in the Winner's Circle. I thought it would have been the greatest thing of all time if you and he were there. I guess both of you had schedule conflicts or something. You couldn't, neither one of you could make it, but that would have been, give Sheikh Mohammed congratulations for me.
I will. I'll let him know. And it was Applebee's fault because I asked if I could hop the jet and go with them right to Melbourne to get to Flemington. No, I want to get there. Have you been? Have you been to?
No, I want to too. That's one of the things I definitely want to do.
Well, yeah, it's high on the list. I know
it's tough with the Breeders' Cup. I mean, that makes
yes
it hard. You're going to be to work it out somehow, but.
Well, the time to do it is when there's a West Coast Breeders' Cup, and you know, then to hop a flight, literally. Although you don't, I don't think you want to miss the whole week before the lead up. I mean, if you just got there on Monday afternoon, and then, you know, be all jet lagged and you know, rubber brain.
Yeah, it's a tough deal. It's even, you know, it's tough on those jockeys when they do it. So, and they just, you know, they're just riding one race. You know, that's a, you know, us gamblers, it's tough. You know, you got to prepare. You know.
I can only imagine, you know, I can only imagine what the in-race trading, what the exchange wagering was like on the winner, because I mean he was a mile back with what, the less than 750 meters to go. It seemed like he was an impossible horse.
Yeah, and a couple of the other favorites weren't traveling bad either, so probably it was not like somebody could go against somebody. You know, it was kind of wide open. Still there. He probably lost. You probably got something if you took it.
If you took that chance. Well,
yeah.
We wanted to do a post-cup evaluation on a number of fronts, and we had Chuck Grubbs, the contest winner, the BCBC winner. He
was
a lot of
fun. That's great. Yeah. That was great.
Well, and
of course, my good friend Jonathan with his crazy bets at the end. If he actually had the right idea. Unfortunately, the way that the BCBC works out, you have to have a good opinion in the last race. Doesn't matter what happens other times, but he really made a good bet, actually.
Well,
in retrospect,
let's talk about the way the changes that were implemented. We talked about it a little bit going in. What, you know, what was your sense, and what are you hearing here, you know, days later about the benefits, the drawbacks, everything that went into the changes?
Well, luckily, I haven't heard anything about the BCBC, which I think is good news. That, you know, when you hear nothing is good. I mean, I saw that they were online and everybody was analyzing everybody's bets. I would rule against that a little bit, because playing in that contest, which you're betting in the contest, is probably not the greatest strategy when you're betting on a day-to-day basis. But there is somewhat of bet a little to win a lot in the contest, but, you know, it's on steroids. You know, you got to. Unfortunately, I never got going. I tried to. I liked it. I mean, you got to bet more races, and you know, the way that contest works out is you have to hit something preliminary to get you in position, and then you have to hit the big one at the end. You have to have both, and I just never had the early one. Though I had a couple of them that I could have. One of the reasons why I was back and forth about getting in the contest, because I didn't want it to be a distraction, and then I just didn't think Rocketry could lose, so I wanted to take a big chance with him. And if I had any money in the first day, I had planned on, you know, betting a lot of money on him. Even so, I did bet a lot of money on him, and I had to narrow it down and just use two exactas, and you know, I didn't pick Dabster, so I had the one that ran third. But that could have changed it a little bit for me. However, you know, like I said, I wouldn't have had the right play at the end either, so I'm not all that upset about it.
I referenced this morning the opportunity for people. It's a 1,000-page PDF that has everybody's wagers straight through. One of the things about it, Paul, that is fascinating, and it includes Chuck Grubbs. I looked at I printed out Nick Tamaros, because Nick will be with us tomorrow, and invariably, and I think this is very encouraging for, you know, meat and potatoes players, weekend players, and you know, smaller budget players, even the biggest, most successful entrance in the contest that finished in the money, that got NHC seats and got prizes, they didn't hit more than two or three races themselves. And
right.
it really reinforces the message about these 2 days that it only takes one. It only takes, you know, one good opinion leveraged properly. And Chuck Grubbs, I thought, gave the greatest instruction on that. He was absolutely cemented to Accelerate, thought that he was just head and shoulders above the field, and then he found Gunavera and keyed Gunavera second and third with all, and had a big win, had several big win bets on Accelerate, and then had the try that put him over the top.
That was my strategy last year. Gunavera missed the, he missed the memo. If he had run second to Gunrunner last year, I would have, I think I would have won the VCBC last year. But, or maybe Duke did, would have, you know, one of us would have. The Gunavera fan club, we actually needed him again. I would have done good for the whole couple days if Gunavera had won, which, you know, that's how it goes. Sometimes, and I got psyched out on the Sadler stuff, which I knew I was gonna, but in retrospect, I'm not all that upset about that either. So,
before we talk, some of the other elements, including the head-to-head, and I know you've got some ideas and some thoughts about the way the races were scored figure-wise. Let's touch on just kind of the way races were run and outcomes that for the most part seemed pretty logical. The Filly and Mare Sprint again produced a big price. I didn't think Shamrock Rose was, you know, we talked about her with Marty McGee on Friday, and you know, there was plenty to like about her. Talk about the results and what you know, what you got right, what you got wrong, what you thought was formful, and what you thought was irksome.
Well, on that race, and since you mentioned that, I'll go to that one, and then maybe we'll go back to the first day real quick. But I like Shalone in that race, and I bet him and I or her, and I didn't bet the race very well because I was too married to Morley's Freedom, and basically played for one of the two to win. And unfortunately for me, I did use the 14 and I did use the 12, and it came out about the only way I didn't hit it. But that was my fault. I bet pretty terrible on that. On a normal race card, in a normal environment, I would have keyed Shalone all the way. I think that's one of the maybe things to learn. Maybe everybody else can learn from my mistake on that too, is that sometimes in the Breeders' Cup, you get out of, you know, if that had been a normal race, I would have been thinking more, if I liked Shalone, I would key it, you know. And then you start thinking that the horses can't lose or because they're better than they are, you know. And really, they're not better, even though they run faster figures and they're faster and they're better. It's still horse racing. And, you know, Baffert had a real good day on Friday. I hadn't at that point had any reason to believe that Morley's Freedom wasn't going to run. So, you know, I should have just keyed Shalone, and I didn't. I played it so that the both of them would be in it and one of them would have to win. So I had a little bit unlucky because I think Shalone probably was the best horse and I would have hit it anyway, but that's racing, you know. I think it was pretty formful. You could see that race was going to collapse. I don't think that was unusual, you know. Especially if you didn't have faith in Sadler, you know, from the rail. So
with Selcourt. Well, but yeah. here's what makes this so challenging, because a couple of things had to happen for you, in your case, for you not to be successful. One is not a straw in the path of Shamrock Rose and a brilliant ride by Errat Ortiz, and then you fold in the fact that, frankly, Mike Smith, I'm sure if he had it back, wouldn't have gone 8 or 9 wide. I mean, I know he's, okay, he's on the favorite, she's even money, I get all that, but you can't ride your horse as if she can't lose. You have to, you know, some of the physics of horse racing apply. When she went that wide, that race was over.
I did mention one thing that I didn't. We always tease each other. I didn't listen to myself. I on one of these things that I talked about, I said if Marley Freeman had a chink in her armor, she was going to be forced to be a little further back, and you didn't know how.
Right,
horse and rider were going to react to that, you know. So, yeah, I guess in that sense you could have predicted it, but she was, you know. We'll get into it later, but the way that the race came out, and she's supposed to run faster than she did, and based on every race
that's
that
true
run for Baffert, she could overcome being 8 wide and still have won on her other races. So, I don't know if we can blame Mike Smith completely. I agree with you; it wasn't the greatest of rides, but you know. You know, riding a 3-5 versus riding a, what was the 14? 25-1, you know, you ride a little differently. You're looking for every edge sometimes, you know. So, yeah, but it's a good point. You make a good point. that's the, of all the races, I think I screwed that one up the most. I should have made a score in that race because I had just about everything about that race right, and I should have cashed something in that race.
Well, and the numbers in here were outlandish. Shamrock Rose paid $53.80. Shalone paid $14.60. And Anonymity, to be third, paid $15.60. This all the benefit of Marley's Freedom being out of the money. And then the exotics were terrific. The Dollar Exacta, $3.60. The Try for a buck paid $6,120. The Super.
You know, I had just forgotten about all that. You know, I just gotten over all this stuff.
And you're... No. Well, that's why we. What else were you struck with, and what you know, what was circumstance and what was top level performers? Take us through.
Well, you know, I also screwed up another race, and you know, the newspaper of record race. That was a race that I should have bet that I didn't, and because I had the idea that the other horses behind Newspaper of Record that ran behind her in New York last time had a chance to run in behind her again. And I kind of got psyched out of the Breeders' Cup in that type of race, too. Though in my defense, I probably would have gotten psyched out if that race hadn't been a Breeders' Cup race either. I just sometimes lose interest when I think a big price favorite's going to win and I don't have anything solid to go behind it. And as it turned out, the four horses that I had marked and used as backups in pick fours and pick fives ran second, third, fourth, and fifth. In fact, there's a chance that somebody that I know might have hit that super that paid real big because I had talked it over with some people and I gave them the five horses and then I sat on my hands and didn't play it. But, you know, that goes back to what you were saying at the beginning, though, because the Breeders' Cup's tough in that, you know, where are you going to put your money and it's gotten to be such a betting extravaganza where you can almost bet so many things. You know, money management is really big on Breeders' Cup Day. And, you know, sometimes you can, and the other thing, too, about when it comes to money management, when it's over 2 days, you know, you can do the right things and be wrong lots of times. You know, I think you and I talked about it last year, you know, sometimes the right thing to do in pick four or pick five, yeah, you won't get paid off in 40, 50 years on the mathematics. It's kind of like the Powerball. You know, there was great equity in it by playing it, but you're not going to go and you know put all your money into it worth because you're not going to see that equity maybe forever. You know, in 10,000 years. You know, and the Breeders' Cup, that kind of principle comes up. You know, where you're doing the right things, but are you, you know, and I think in as far as the BCBC, going back to that, I think what Jonathan does good is that he takes out the idea of, he takes it more about the probability of horses that are going to win. So he brings that down a little bit, you know, he cuts that back where if you're playing 20 to 1 shots in the BCBC, that should be, you know, that should be 15 to 1. You know, you can go a lifetime and never cash, you know. And I think maybe in the contest, the idea is to not to go so much for value as you normally would in your normal betting. You want to take into account the probability of winning more.
That's a great topic to stick with for a second because. To my way of thinking and in terms of building the multi-race wagers both days, to me, Newspaper of Record was the single, go ahead and stand there. And I didn't think I was doing this until Saturday morning. And when I built my plays and put them out there in the analysis, singled and able. And the lesson here is, speaking to that, that if you accept the reasonable prospect that horses like that are going to win their races, that something unusual is going to have to happen to stop them from winning, and then build from there, both of those races, despite the short price of the winners, produced wonderful, impactful exotics.
Yeah, Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. And, you know, like you said, in the Breeders' Cup is the rare opportunity sometimes, like if you're playing Finger Lakes and you got a, you know, a 3-5 you think's going to win, there's nothing there that you can make any money with. In the Breeders' Cup, that's not the case. And definitely not the VCVC, you know. So it's definitely a different animal, that's for sure, you know.
Well, and you make a great point that I hadn't connected that dot, actually, among, you know, looking at the charts, that in fact Stellar Age and Varenka, you know, were behind Newspaper of Record, you know, going back to the performance at Belmont. And virtually anybody that looked at this race knew that East and Just Wonderful were the Euros that you wanted.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. They were the obvious two horses to play. They were the only two horses probably that had a chance to beat Newspaper of Record, and even that was unlikely. But you know, and then you take the other two horses, and bang, it's that easy for 98,000. You know, the
unbelievable,
super high.
Well, you know, and that is a hidden. You know, Jamie Spencer's ride on East to get second in a losing effort. That was a fabulous trip that he worked out from the 14 hole.
Yeah, you know, the riding in general I thought was pretty good for the Breeders' Cup. I haven't always had that feeling afterwards. And some of these Breeders' Cups, sometimes I think, you know, that it isn't so good. But I thought for the most part, there was a couple here and there. I don't think Jose Ortiz was very good. I know people were saying that it was his mounts, but he didn't ride very good. And I don't know, there was a couple here and there. But for the most part, I thought the riding was pretty good. You know, and the riding in the Breeders' Cup Turf by the Tory and Ryan Moore was really good, in the, you know, showing you you know, how you ride on soft turf. And neither one of them, I think the Tory, if it had been a lesser jockey, could have been baited down to saving too much ground and staying on the bad inside and actually getting caught up in the pace. I thought he did a tremendous job, even though I still think she was the best horse when it was all said and done. Sometimes good, you have to ride good on the best horse.
Absolutely,
he definitely gave a great ride in that scenario.
Before we talk about some other results, let's pause and look at the first head-to-head opportunity which came in this race, and the USA Europe and Newspaper of Record, you know, felt so you know, so sure and pays. Well, on a $2 bet, pays $2.60. What
was the hiccups in the, you know, the head to heads? You know, I'm not going to say it was negative or anything about that. Hopefully, they can build on it. I think the concept was introduced on this Breeders' Cup, and that was all that mattered. We're going to work on trying to get the takeout down. We're going to try to get this breakage thing. I talked to Drew from the Breeders' Cup, and he's working even past the Breeders' Cup to breaking some of this stuff down that's stopping the industry from having low takeout and having breakage based on $10 and $100. So, you know, I'm going to look at it. It wasn't ideal the way it all came off. That race there, to kick it off with that one was a little disappointing to me, because I think for this idea to work, they have to be close to 50-50. You know, and this was one that was going to be, that wasn't going to be 50-50 and right from the get-go. And it was basically Newspaper Record versus the other two horses. And, you know, not every race has a great story, unfortunately. But I think over time that can build. And it's the idea, you know, and to build off of those things and build off of the ideas. I mean, the first time ever that anybody's had the chance to bet against the horse, you know, technically pseudo exchange wagering with Enable, you know, so you had your opportunity. If you didn't like Enable, you could bet against it. That's never happened before. I think that was pretty historic, you know. You know, if we can just keep moving forward off of these things, I knew this year was never going to be a, that's why when we talked last time, I just didn't want everybody to get down on it, because this is going to be a bet that's going to grow. And my hope is that the things that are within the bet become the normal of horse racing. That's That's the idea, like we said last year.
Didn't the $21 pay in the boys' race in the juvenile turf an hour later, that was the
well,
best.
That was a good one.
That was crazy. Well, because it didn't make any sense. Every year, the Euros win the boys' race, and Chad Brown wins the girls' race. I saw that number up there, and I said, even I went ahead. I mean, I wasn't going to really play them, and then I said, well, this is nuts.
Yeah, it was a good play. Yeah, and that was a good one because that was a 50-50 one or a little bit. You know, I don't mind if it's a little bit over 50-50. You know, but we don't want to set down, you know, in a $2 payout. We just don't want to have those 250s and 260s. Like, we had a couple of them, you know.
Right.
That's disheartening to me because I think that's – for the success of the bet, you don't want that happening every time, you know. I want it to be more or less, you know, a sports bet where you're going to get that certain amount every time. It may vary a little here and there, but for by and large, you're going to get – you know, and if you're paying attention like you did, you might get the $4 one here and there. But I'd like to see him be more, you know, 50-50.
Before we go to Saturday's other races, what did you think of the two juvenile winners, Game Winner and Jaywalk?
Well, you know, the Jaywalking race, I that's another mistake I made. I didn't see her getting the lead, even though I was against Bellafina mainly. And I knew the race was over once she got the lead. I'd like to see what she does without the lead before we crown her anything special. She's obviously really talented. You know, I guess it went formful after the fact once you knew she was going to get the lead. I didn't expect her to get the lead. And I guess in retrospect, you could have. I that was probably a handicap mistake on my part, but not one that I'm kicking myself over completely. But it did. It was just perfect. It knocked me out of all my, in the middle of all the horizontals. It was the perfect race to knock me out, right? You know, where I had some opinions that were right. So, but that's how it goes. And unfortunately, for the boys' end, I was, you know, for me, when Shug's Horse came out, that kind of changed the race for me, Code of Honor, because then it became more where I thought that the favorite would win. And that he could overcome a trip, which he did, to win. I'm not sure about him going forward. You know, but I've said that a couple times. I looked back at my notes when I was handicapping the Breeders' Cup, and it was funny. I have it almost on every race. You know, pretty impressive, but I'm not so sure. And I kind of had the same feeling about him here too. So I don't know about him. Going forward, he might just be ahead of the game. Baffert's other two-year-old was pretty impressive, that one earlier in the day.
Improbable.
Improbable. He was really impressive. So he's at least competition for him. And he might have been the most impressive two-year-old that ran on Friday, I thought. You know, he overcame a lot and still won easy and had a ton at the end. So, but both races weren't, you know, nothing earth-shattering happened in either one of them. Like I said, the scratch probably, you know, that was bad for me.
Hey, going into Saturday, Paul, after we've talked about the filly and mare sprint, don't know how much of a lesson the turf sprint completely is, but I'll say this. Invariably, when it comes to Monday through Sunday turf sprint handicapping and wagering, there's a tendency to believe that it's a chaotic scenario in the offing. And here was, you know, 14 turf sprinters, and we ended up with the three top choices, 1, 2, 3, or 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, very logical result. You know,
yeah.
The figures weren't easy to do in that race, but I think, you know, the one thing I take from this, and maybe as a learning lesson, you know, I haven't done a lot of turf sprints with, you know, on soft turf, or it doesn't surprise me that's formful, you know, like in the long run. And I think that probably that would be the case. You know, I don't think that would be a scenario where it's chaos anyway. We're I think maybe some people would think that, and this just reinforces these races, the two of them there, the juvenile one as well as the turf sprint, and that form will hold up on these soft turf races on soft going. That's kind of what I took from the race. I'm a little surprised that Stormy Liberal could be that good, because the other horse really ran his race. But he's gotten good, you know, and there were signs that he was getting that good. He had run really well in the Santa Anita race down the hill, and he's probably better at 5.5. That might be his ideal distance. You know, he's won at 5 and he's won at 6.5, but that's probably exactly if you wanted to nail the perfect distance for him, it would be 5.5. So it wasn't certainly not shocking.
Well, you mentioned how well Stormy Liberal ran and World of Trouble. I had Andy Beyer on Monday, Paul, to discuss the Big Fig, and one of the suggestions Andy made in more or less saying that he is very confident in the high fig that he gave the top pair, 119 and 118 on his scale. One point that he made that is really to be remembered by, I think, by people going forward: we have so few opportunities in this country to see our turf horses at any distance run over soft turf. Track supers and track management invariably, because of the value to them during the course of a meet, the value to them of the turf course, you know, holding it together and keeping it in good shape, they take races off the turf so readily that we just don't see it. And Andy, I thought, made a really good point when he said, for all we know, these are two horses that move forward on soft turf, but we generally don't get a chance to make that evaluation.
No, and I don't want to get too technical on this, but I think there's a couple things that happened in the race that it wasn't that fast of a pace, even under the scenario of the soft turf, which sometimes on soft turf, and why I think we see some chaotic results in soft turf going longer, is it doesn't take much in soft turf to make the race be a fast pace. You know, like you would think that sometimes a 25 can be a fast pace, you know, if you're going a mile and a quarter, which is kind of like goes against the rational you're thinking, you know. But in turf sprints, the way it worked out, the pace was relatively slow. I had World of Trouble running basically the same thing that he had run last time, if not a little slower. So it would kind of go in my thinking that he would run a few ticks faster than he did last time. So I agree with what Andy said about that he's right about the figure. Like I said, I don't want to get too technical. The only thing that I would like to say is that, you know, he was saying, and he always says, that it's a big gap, and he's right. That when there's a big gap, it's usually a sign that the time was good. And a soft turf, you know, we're comparing these distances, and for the most part, they're finishing up races at the same speed. But if you want to be technical, when you're comparing distances, I don't think what you're doing is comparing distances. You're comparing times and how fast they're running at the end of the race, and that dictates how much horses get spread apart. So the big gap between the second and third horse has a little bit to do with the slowing down from the soft turf, so that you really wouldn't compare it to that 7.5 lengths at 5.5 furlongs on a soft turf doesn't equal exactly 7.5 lengths on a firm turf. Now, I mean, you and I could talk about that forever, but so it makes the race a little bit tricky to do, and how you want to go about it. Even with that said, it's fast. The race is fast, and you know, more than likely, it's probably not quite as fast as Andy had it, and the horses below him probably still ran the same thing, because he's bound to this chart that he has to use for the time. So you can't get everything right when you're bound to that kind of chart. But for everybody listening, if you want to go about it, you know, on these soft turf races, you might want to, the spread may not be as important. So if you see a horse run a lower figure because he's beaten up a little bit more on a turf spread, he probably ran his race. Like Disco Partner, for example, and the horse that ran fourth, Ruby Notion. They're a little on the low side figures-wise, and I'm guessing they're not. I think they probably ran their, you know, their closer to their typical race, especially the Ruby Notion.
I appreciate that. Because I know some people, and I have heard a couple of people say it's probably a couple of ticks high, but the reality is they went. I mean, the two of them really ran.
Right. Anybody who's saying that it's way off, they're wrong. You know, it's not like it was 98 or anything like that. That'd be crazy.
Looking ahead, the Dirt Mile and City of Light turned in, you know, what was one of the top performances, obviously, of the weekend. We talked to Michael McCarthy. A lot of fun to celebrate his success, and lost in the crush of results discussion. Bravanzo ran a nice race to be third and was half a dozen clear of Firenze Fire. And nice job by Lucas and the Calumet team. Louis Contreras hits the board. Seeking the Soul, I had seen Dallas Stewart one morning and I said, sorry you didn't get in the Classic. He said, that's okay, we're going to win that mile race. And Seeking the Soul ran well, and now we'll look toward a try in the Pegasus.
I had Seeking the Soul. I had a future book on Seeking the Soul to win the Breeders' Cup Classic, like from way back. And I think it's funny. He's going to run a higher figure than the Classic winner on the day of the Breeders' Cup. But not saying he would win anyway. But I just thought that was funny. We're talking about figures. I think this is the key race of the day on Saturday for the figures. This race is extremely fast. I don't know, but I guess before I get into that, I couldn't have been more wrong about this race in that I had a big opinion on Firenze Fire, and I thought at worst case scenario he was going to run second to City of Light. I'd almost gotten to the point where I didn't like Catalina Cruiser at all. I was getting there more and more as the race went, and I knew that if City of Light could show more speed than he showed at Saratoga, he would be tough in this race. I thought they had the right plan. Nobody really went after him early, so they had to use him a little bit more, but it was a smart move. Maybe the post helped them. Maybe that got them in their heads that they had to send more. But not a shocking result by means. I was a little disappointed that Firenze Fire ran as bad as he did. He did get put away by City of Light, and sometimes that's how it works out. But I still thought he was – I was completely wrong about him, and I'm not exactly sure why. But – as far as figures-wise, this is what I find interesting about Breeders' Cup. I mean, I'm a figures dork, so, you know, I would. But I think everybody else will, too, because this is going to be interesting for betting off of. You have three races that were very formful when you did the figures before the turf race. And then we came out with this City of Light race. And it is extremely fast, the City of Light race. And anybody who's doing figures is going to have to make a decision about, did the track change at this point in the day? Because you follow it right back up with the Roy H. race, which is extremely fast. And I've been, frankly, I'm not sure exactly what to do, but I've been really curious to see what other people are doing. And I read somewhere that CJ with Timeform, he said he cheated a little. So I'm not sure exactly what he did. But the two that are funny, and you'll know, is that Thoroughgraph with Jerry Brown basically has gone to where he's not using a daily variant. With the way the racing has gone, he is breaking these races out, and every race is a different variant. And I can't say as I blame him, whether it's because natural occurrences or the way that they're maintaining the track nowadays, that's a different argument, but that's the way he's gone. And the sheets have not made that leap. They are going by what it's always been considered the right thing to do, is to use one variant. And in this, I haven't seen the Thoroughgraph sheets, but I've seen some of Jerry Brown's comments, and I know he's gonna break those races out, and they're not gonna be that fast. The figures tweet or the sheets figured their figures out, and City of Light ran one of the fastest races ever, and the other horse there in the sprint,
Roy H,
he ran like the fastest figure ever because they didn't break it out, and they have used one variant for the whole day. I've seen a lot of different ideas come down the pike, which makes some of the other races slow. If you go one way, if you take them out and completely project them, you can have the Monte Miguel race and the Accelerate race be okay and somewhat fast. You can go the other way and have them be real slow. It's a real good study in doing speed figures and how they're going to be different for everybody. And you mentioned Bravazo. That's one of the problems I have in keeping with one variant. You know, I'm having a hard time believing that Bravazo ran, you know, like 112 buyer or a, you know, a one on the sheets. It's got to be on the sheets ridiculous because he was wide too. So, I mean, they're going to give Bravazo one of the fastest figures of the year, you know, and of many years, you know. And I'm having a hard time believing that, but he is three, and things change. It's a very difficult decision to make on these figures, and it's funny. It comes down to me on three horses, the two I mentioned, Seeking the Stolen Bravazo, and also Whitmore in the sprint. So, you know, you have a different view. I mean, what do you think? You think, because I've been asking everybody. I have one brother that tells me there's no way they had to change the track, and I got another brother who says, I was there. They didn't change the track all day, so it didn't change. Nothing changed. There was no weather change. What's your feeling on these two races? Do you think they could possibly be the fastest two races ever?
No. I mean, City of Light certainly, and the fact that you've got such a spread between, you know, virtually every, what, the top six, top six finishers. Yeah, three lengths, 2.5, 6 lengths, 3.25, 3. I mean, they really spread out in the
mile. Yeah, it was
definitely
good. It was definitely fast, doesn't matter what you do.
Exactly.
Right.
But Paul, one thing about that track, the day got nicer and nicer. The sun was out fully, you know, by early afternoon, and there was plenty of moisture in that track to start the day. And you could see, you know, there was still, you know, that clay moisture that you were walking on the track apron. And as the day wore on, the dirt races, the horses coming back were having less of that muddy spray, that you know, that wet, misty mud that shows up on their chest and forelegs. And, you know, the track kept drying out as the day went on. And so, I mean, there is going to be some change. I mean, it feels like Monomoy Girl, that came back a little slow. That seems apparent.
Well, it kind of depends on what you do. I mean, this is a very difficult day to do the figures. If you want to break out those two races, and just use all the other races, Monte Miguel's race is okay. It's basically what she had run in her last, or pretty close to it, maybe a little low. I do think the pace was a little slow in the Monte Miguel race.
Absolutely was slow.
Yeah, and and also, it's not going to be fast because I don't think the horses behind him were going to go. It's not a race where I would say that Wow Girl went way through her, you know, last figure, and she obviously is improving, but it's going to be similar to a race at Belma, and, you know, the Blue Prize I think ran similar, and I think they all ran the race, so it's going to land in there somewhere. But I want to tell you, you can take a different outlook at all. I mean, the last two races are a little slow. Accelerate and the Danny Gargan horse who won the feature, you know.
Divine Miss Gray.
Divine Miss Gray. So, I want to tell you, I sat and I've looked at these figures for hours, and I still don't know what I'm going to do. And that's why I'm curious to hear what everybody else says. I think I'll have a pretty good line when those three horses that I mentioned come back, I mean, if Bravado wins the cigar mile or something by chance or something like that, well, then, you know, then Roy Yates actually is the fastest horse that's ever lived. You know, you can maybe make that assumption, but it's tough to do that right now. I'm with you. I'm leaning on breaking it out. I actually used three variants on my initial thoughts, that I have the first three races, then I have the next two, and then I break out the end of the day. And I really don't like doing that. I mean, it goes against everything to go that the track went slow, fast, or slower. You know, that doesn't make sense to me. So it's going to be really interesting to see. Unfortunately, that's probably the worst thing about the Breeders' Cup is we don't get to see these horses run back quickly off of these races. And you have these opinions and things that happen on this day, and then, you know, you have to use them sparingly for the next couple months. But we'll all have an answer probably at some point, you know, what happened. But I don't think it's easy to say that one person is right and one person is wrong on this. I think it's going to be interesting when these figures pop up, and definitely for anybody else who's using them, because I'm sure nobody nowadays does their own figures, to, you know, be aware that this day is not the most simplest day to do figures.
Well, and especially because you do get, you know, you do get the track groomed after the race, and then it sits, you know, like it does on Derby Day, and they alternate from, you know, from dirt to turf, dirt to turf. So, you know, the filly and mare sprint went off at noon. The dirt mile went off at 1:25. The sprint went off at 2:50. The distaff at 4:20, and then the feature at 5:50. So you got an hour and a half between each race, and you know, 3 hours, 4.5, 6 hours from, you know, from start to finish. And that racetrack, the way it dries and the clay content and, you know, the variable on that front is pronounced. I mean, it's an amazing track that way. I mean, the fact that it was you had a fast track, more or less, you know, good and then fast, you know, the 2 days is miraculous considering how much rain came.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah, that's for sure.
Now, Paul, the classic itself, you know, watching replays and you know, one of the things that has come out, you know, Mike Welch, Mike made a tremendous, in retrospect, and Rich Yang, who we're going to talk to later, Rich also was beating this drum. Mike Welch told everybody on, Thursday, I guess. Welch, his one prevailing opinion was that the three-year-olds were a pack of weak sisters in that, going into that classic. And Mike said the one thing that he knew going in for his own approach was that he was against the three-year-olds. And Rich Yang was the same way. And that opinion was an interesting approach and ended up being right.
Yeah, I would agree with that to a point. The only thing I will say, and watching this race again, I don't know what their plans are. But I think it's a little unfortunate that Mendelsohn is not getting a chance to run and develop more like a horse in the United States does. He was kind of, and I'm, this is not a, I actually like the way he's been able to develop because they know Brian trained him. I think that probably an American trainer, the wrong one, might have already broken him down. But he's been in two wicked paces in scenarios where he's running against very, you know, high competition. And if we had seen a scenario where Mendelsohn got a, let's say, an American Pharoah type lead in some of the races that he did, Mendelsohn would have the opportunity to show how good he is. He'd win by a mile if he got off easy. And he's getting better. I mean, I think every race that he's run in this country has been better, which is probably the way that they wanted to do it. That's probably the way that they plan to train him. And I don't know. You know, you don't want to go and say that you're impressed by a horse who's run second, third, fifth. You know, but it's a pretty good accomplishment based on race scenarios and 3-year-old running against older horses. That he's had to face. I mean, if he went and ran on a normal, you know, like Liam's Met type pace where he could get off easy in the Whitney or, you know, or the other race, the Woodward, you know, he would have that same kind of performance. There's no doubt in my mind. And I don't think he's stopped improving yet. So I would hope that he would run some more, but you know, there's so much money in breeding and that's a different story. And I can understand if they don't, but, I think we've gotten shortchanged a little bit on him. As far as the other three-year-olds, you know, I couldn't argue with anything that, Duke's been preaching that for right along, that the three-year-olds haven't been any good. And he's been right, you know, especially, you know, I thought Audible was kind of impressive in his race.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It kind of got lost on the undercard. To win going sprinting like that and to do it as easy, and I thought he looked better going off the track than he did coming on. He looked unbelievable, I thought. So, this crop between those two, maybe a late developer, it may turn out to be all right down the road. You know, so I wouldn't marry it to yourself to that all for all next year. But at this juncture, I can agree with that assessment. You know, I think both foreign horses showed that they were, you know, they're not great horses, but they're pretty good horses. Thunder Snow and Mendelssohn after the whole thing. I don't think it's an easy task for those horses to come over and do as well as they have done in all these races, you know. And they've taken a lot of ridicule because of their derbies, but they were pretty good horses, both of them. You know, it's not the greatest older group horses, so, you know, maybe it's but they're game, good horses, and both of them are front runners, which is unusual. And I'd be interesting to see, like, you know, a different trainer that in America, if they had Thunder Snow, or if Bob Baffert trained Thunder Snow or Mendelssohn, those horses would have high speed, you know, and you would see how good they were, you know. I don't know, maybe they wouldn't make it to the races away sometimes, you know. But if they made it, and I would guess that they would because how tough they've been, you know, and it'd be interesting. The international racing is a funny bird. You have these scenarios where you think afterwards and, you know, I don't like all this definitive talk about, you know, this horse is the best and this horse is that because he shipped, you know, halfway across the country and won this race and this one half, you know, it's kind of tough to, it's tough to weigh it all, you know, and that's what, and I think if you're handicapping all this, don't get caught up in all the hyperbole of all that. You can see good performances within some of these races, you know?
Oh, no doubt. And, you know, Andy talks about this all the time, about how overly results-oriented everybody wants to be, and that, you know, that this is more of a, this is an organic exercise. I mean, these are, you know, these are horses, you know, particularly when it comes to, you know, the two and three and then even into four as horses mature, you know, it's an ongoing evolution of performance and experience and so forth. And, I mean, we tried to caution people don't evaluate Thunder Snow and Mendelssohn based on their experience in their respective derbies. I mean, that was completely unfair. The horse that was ultimately personally a bit of a throwout, and it seems in retrospect kind of odd was the use of Roaring Lion. Why they did this with him? I don't really know.
I don't think that completely the Europe understands the whole idea of dirt racing and
Well, Gosden does. I mean, Gosden certainly with his U.S. experience, you know, training, and it would seem that I know he. You know, what's funny now that I think about it too, he did say the owner is gung ho. There was the code word.
I had heard that, you know,
yeah.
But it was pretty apparent once you started thinking about that he was going to be in trouble, that Thunder Snow or the Roaring Lion was going to be in trouble. And frankly, I think he was under-talented. That's why it made it easy for me because I got to the point where he's not good enough even if he
takes to the
was
dirt.
As good on dirt as turf. So it became easy to throw him out. But, You know, I think people in that normally deal with turf horses, and I'm not saying that all turf horses are this way, but I think they underestimate how good dirt horses are. You know, there's this feeling that just that, you know, dirt racing has got this negative stigma to it in a lot of these places, and they, because they don't understand it, it's a little foreign to them. But the thing that they don't understand, and they think that because they don't understand it and that these horses aren't any good, these dirt horses that run a mile and a quarter are the best horses in the world. They're the most talented. That's why they're the best stallions. That's why the people from other countries come back, because we sort them out and we have the best dirt horses. And if you underestimate that, you can make big mistakes like you do with Roaring Lion. And that's not to say when you have good horses like Mendelssohn and Thunderstone, you shouldn't try, because they are really good horses, and they will be good stallions because they are good horses. But, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than, and I think the more that we see turf racing in this country, some of the people in this country are going to make that mistake that, you know, all right, this is a turf horse and, you know, she was a great horse, but that, and the turf, but that doesn't necessarily translate that she was a really great horse, you know, or a better horse than other dirt counterparts.
Well, and frankly, the success of horses like Catholic Boy and Yoshida moving seemingly interchangeably between surfaces, that is only going to encourage that line of thinking.
And I think that's a good thing, because I'd like to see some of these horses. I think some of these turf horses don't get a shot at proving greatness, you know? You know, I mean, like, I was a critic of Yoshida. I wasn't sold on him completely, even though my brother and some other people had been a fan of the horse right from the get-go. You know, and I had my doubts about him, but I don't anymore, obviously. And, you know, he's a very good horse, and he translated that he wasn't running that distance of ground just because of the turf. The turf was working against him. You know what I mean? He was at a disadvantage from running the turf, but I think there's a lot of horses. Take a look at his rocketry. I mean, if you want another a perfect example, you know, I mean, you know, he's run on turf all this time, and you know, he's broken two track records. He's run on the dirt twice, and he's done it easy as can be, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
granted, oddball distances, but
right.
Still,
yeah.
But still,
don't be surprised if Rocketry is competitive at a mile and a quarter on the dirt coming down the road. He's a little bit better than probably what people think.
Oh, and in Jimmy's hands, and Jimmy Jerkins' hands, and that is another one of the performances of the weekend that got kind of lost in the shuffle. Rocketry's win in the marathon, going the mile and three quarters, following up on his mile and five eighths win. And I agree, Jimmy. You watch what Jimmy does with him.
He'll get him to go. He'll get him to show a little bit more speed and not get lost. You know, and you know, the way that the way some of these mile and a quarter races go, he'll be competitive.
Paul, I got a great question. Aaron in Garden City calling with a question, asking about the back to the speed for a second, the one turn versus the two turn element, and how that may play into some of the murky elements of the figures on the day.
Yeah, well, I went that direction, you know, and even if you take out the fact that the filly and mare sprint there collapsed, and that could be as slow as anything because it was a collapse. Even though I don't think it was, it wasn't a high figure, obviously, but I don't think it was, you know, like in the 80s or anything on the buyer scale. You still had the other two races that sprinted, and Audible was one of them, and the Divine Miss Gray was the other that went a mile. And if you're going to go with the idea and take them out, both of those races are going to be slow. And I'm not convinced of that. Divine Miss Gray has run about 15 or 16 races in a row since Danny Garden claimed her in the same vicinity as a figure. And she won this race. So I don't have any reason to believe that she regressed in that race. And like I said, I was kind of impressed with Audible. I know nobody's talked about him at all. And, you know, I thought he was vulnerable in that spot, you know, coming out and running 7 furlongs. And, I mean, he just did it as easy as can be, you know. And I just don't believe that he didn't run his race, or if not better, being an older. So, I don't believe that he would run, say, like 90-something or a low 90s figure in that race. I mean, I looked at that direction, but I don't think that backs it up. But somebody might take that view. That's why I say this is going to be very interesting. I mean, you talk about handicap and speed figures. I think you'd have a different opinion right down the line. You know, I think probably more people think that the track would have sped up because you don't believe that Roy H can run 125 by your number, or a minus 1.5 or whatever he ran on the sheets. They published it, I think, minus 1. So most people are probably going to side against that, but, you know, he was pretty impressive. And, you know, I'm like I said, I don't know what to do, frankly.
All right, we'll keep waiting because it's already Thursday. Obviously, Jerry Brown's had his hands full making the numbers, because by now, usually, he's published the 2 days.
Yeah, he'll put them out, right?
At some point. I would think today or tomorrow. But obviously, if they're not out by Wednesday, that means Jerry's he's grappling with those same questions. And it'll be very interesting to see what he does. It never is. The game's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be a challenge.
For sure.
Overall, Paul, between the racing aesthetically and the individuals involved, and then for the wagering equation, your overall thoughts about how this one stands up over time?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, the Enable is definitely going to be the big thing that people are going to remember, because it's
great.
You know, and it was good that she came. I think the Breeders' Cup people maybe overemphasized the Europe participation, but I guess it was what makes it unique. But they really got lucky that she decided to come this year. I think it was, or they deserve credit for enticing her to come, whatever it took to get her, because I think it was really important. You know, I think, because I've been more into this industry stuff in the last year, so I've been thinking more about industry issues and stuff. And, you know, I had this idea that the Breeders' Cup could influence the industry. And my take after the fact is that the Breeders' Cup is still a result of what's going on in the industry. You know, the racing is still, you know, it almost can't change it. You know, some of the issues that you see on a daily basis, you see in the Breeders' Cup. The idea that these horses don't run a lot going into the Breeders' Cup makes handicapping pretty hard, and you got to make different decisions that, at least for me, different decisions that I would like to make, you know, about horses, how they're going to run. You know, I think you can get fooled easily, like I did with Frenzy Fire. With a lot of time, I thought he would run his A race, and, you know, you talk about all these layoffs, and everybody says, well, they won because we gave it time, but there was a lot of horses lost who got a lot of time in between races too, you know. So, and you see that, you know, completely. Obviously, the turf participation of the American trainers, you can see how racing is. Again, I don't think that's the Breeders' Cup controlling that. I just think that's a result of you're going to continue to see our trainers. I mean, Todd Pletcher had no dirt horses in the Breeders' Cup. He had only turf runners. Which, you know, I liked his horse in the, we didn't talk about that race, and I screwed that up completely. But, and you know what? I actually did a good job. I got myself into the point where that horse was going to get the lead, and was the best horse, but I didn't use Wesley, so.
Yeah, the Chelsea Cloisters, Chelsea Cloisters, the way she hung on, I couldn't have used, even after the fact, I wasn't going to be on a ticket.
No, that was too bad. And I had the horse who ran third really good with her too. So, but with him, but you know, those are the things that I take from it. I think racing's in transition, you know, and you see a lot of these things. I hope that I think there's a lot of positive things and there's a lot of negative things, and hopefully, you know, the positive things weigh out, you know. And dealing with more of the industry people, I think sometimes they get a bad name. I think they're trying. It's just it's a tough thing to break down. You know, we've had racing yep. for a long time in this country, and there's a lot of regulations and a lot of things that you got to break down to make it so that we get it to a better place. And hopefully we can keep doing that.
Well, Paul, as always, greatly appreciate the insights on all these points on the compass. And
when Sheik Mohammed wins the Derby, I want to see you in the winner's circle.
I'm going to be... I don't know. I think
he might be. The first person he hugs. Maybe he can hug Kieran or Appleby, whoever wins it first. But then he better make his way down to see you.
He doesn't strike me as a hugger. You know,
that's a good point. But you know what? If he wins the Derby, he might be. You never know.
I love it. Well, Paul, I can't thank you enough. Tremendous.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks.
Talk soon. Paul Matisse, everybody. It's just so good. And, winning the NHC was maybe the most important thing. To have somebody like Paul kind of drawn out more into the public eye, because he and Duke and Chick and the Matisse family, they were well known around here and in the Saratoga area. But Paul's win in the NHC really has been outstanding for the sport, because Paul coming out and being being willing to involve himself with industry organs and to have his insight, given the level of play that he and his brother and father, the whole family, among the biggest players in the sport, having their insight is just invaluable to the game. And Paul's been very, very active since the NHC win. Including in trying to make some of these new concepts happen on the betting menu at BC, and that's why I thought it was a little hypercritical, to be on the attack on every on every topic. They're trying to push the peanut, as we say. So. Thanks to Paul. Let's take a break. We got to get Tony Black in here before Steve Askin, because I'm not going to pave over another Tony Black visit. A bunch of things to talk about with him. Then Steve Askin. Got to get to Brad Cox and Rich Eng on this Thursday edition. Plus, I got to fit in. We ran yesterday in the feature off the turf, and boy, the Philly ran great. I thought she was going to be third, and just got caught late and passed to end up fifth, Carlisle Bell. But thanks to Dylan Davis, Rajiv was going to ride, and then I don't know what – I didn't even ask Gary what happened. But we lost Rajiv, and he got Dylan, and Dylan rode her great. She needs distance. We can't get a mile race to go, for God's sake. Get a mile race at the right level for her. But she's a hard trier, and Dylan rode her to basically stay in contact, and then she put in that nice run, and then just got tired late. So good. Wasn't unhappy. I would have been thrilled to be third in there. Against good state bred fillies allowance. She's 40 non-winners of two at a mile. See if Mike Lakehout can't write one of those now that he's back for the aqueduct season. Take a break. And Kid Chocolate's running on Saturday in the first. Happy to, assuming that supposedly it's supposed to rain again tomorrow. It's ridiculous. Tony Black joins us next. We'll see if Tony's got what Tony's next mount. He keeps slipping in these Sunday wins. That's his MO the last month and a half. catch up with Tony after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up with ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use ExpressFund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void where prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.